going. So it's a nice toy to have. As the prices go down, I could see where more and more people will, you know, have one just for the heck of it.
Okay, now what type of thing do you have then? What's this hooked up to that you describe that a little bit better, Roy? What kind of a gadget is this?
It's an infrared detector. It's an infrared sensor that has, in the case of that particular model, a lightning connector that connects to your iPhone. So you plug it into power, you charge it up, the battery charges. You plug its lightning connector to your iPhone. You run an application. It superimposes the iPhone's camera with the infrared imaging of the detector that's the FLR detector. You can Google it on you could just do a search on Amazon, and FLIR sells a series of different models with different resolutions and such, and you can adjust the thermal range and the imagery and see exactly what temperature things are. Sometimes people use equipment like that to test electrical equipment that's overheating. They point the camera down and they see the hot spots and the cold spots. So it's a great toy. Again, it's a little overpriced right now. It goes for $300+, but it's called FLIR. So just do a search on FLIR on Amazon, and you'll see a number of different models.
Amazing. Okay. I wrote it down. Thanks, Roy. Okay.
Okay, so we have invisibility. So somebody would like to be invisible, and the technology is moving. When we were talking about that subject a few years ago with Dick, now is a different story. Technology moved. We're dealing with something that is being called metamaterial that is cloaking. There is some physical property that is present in invisibility. That is the refractive index that affects the path of light. And when the beam of light crosses the interface between the two different materials, its path is altered depending on the difference in the refractive indices of the material. The greater the difference, the greater the refraction of the beam. So for all known naturally occurring materials, the refractive index assumes only positive values, but now we're talking about the negative one. I believe Dr. Roy could help me out to explain this much better because his accent is not that heavy. So we were talking before about the Brewster angle, that is a special kind of the angle, but we're not going to talking about it right now. But if we could bend the light, which we're not bending because you cannot bend the photon, you can actually deal with refraction and refraction, reflection and refraction, we could actually make the object invisible. Dr. Roy.
Well, again, in theory, yes. In practice, it's very problematic because you would have to wrap it around the object you want to be invisible. Now, if the object is a grain of rice, you got a chance. If the object is you, I don't know of any metamaterial that would sufficiently accomplish that. That's asking way too much. So it's a matter of scale. In the theoretical and the very, very teeny tiny, you might get away with it. There are probably some fingerprints left behind that a detection scheme will develop that people will be able to tell when you're using that technology. But, yeah, we were talking about metamaterial way back in Dick's time. I remember Dick kind of asking me what is a material, what do you call a material that isn't a metamaterial? And I think I answered, I think you call that a material. We've been talking about that and with negative refractory indexes again. I think the problem is when you start to scale things up from anything bigger than a rice grain, there's a lot of mechanical problems with that technology that I don't think anyone's demonstrated.
Definitely there is a lot of problem, but I believe that actually I love you for being so skeptic. Dr. Roy, this is beautiful. If you don't break, you're going to crash. And that's what you're actually helping me to avoid. Not go too much, because it's going to look funny, but at the same time, I may crash. And you did it so many times, so thank you for that. Metamaterial. Well, first, before that, we're going to a fiber optic. Fiber optic actually uses the phenomenon of light that is trapped inside of the glass conduit. But in one of my videos, if you remember, Dr. Roy, there was a medium in the bucket that was flowing down, and we were able to, I forgot what was the material, it wasn't water, it was glycol, there was a glycol. Okay, and we were able to actually trap the light of the laser inside of it. Similar to that, mechanism, instead of trapping light inside the fiber optic and sending it thousands of kilometers or miles away to the receiver, we could actually transverse that light or provided light around the object. And that's by a complicated pattern of refraction and reflection. And metamaterial cloaking is the usage of old materials that allows that invisibility to happen. And is being done by manipulating the paths transverted by the light through the novel optical material. Usually it's nanofiber. Metamaterials direct the control of the propagation and transmission of specified part of the light spectrum and demonstrate the potential to render an object seemingly invisible. I know that the military uses it. It's not that they work on it, they use it on the field. One of the companies that doesn't make too much of the secret form, it is Canadian camouflage company, Hyper Stealth Biotechnology, we're not talking about the old technology, it's November 2019 that article was provided, and the pictures and the videos with the presentation is also included. So you see the person seemingly disappearing while the wall is showing no changes, or you could see on the edge of the material that is in front of the person, see half of the person vertically cut and through the wall. Again, that's Hyper Stealth Biotechnology. It's patented technology. I'm not sure if it's used by military. They deal with Rochester. I was dealing with Rochester. There was a time when I had a guy from NASA, Alexander Martins, who was actually the guy who was helping me out to go through the number of government SBR programs that I was cooperating with not only NASA, but the Department of Defense, DARPA, and so whatsoever. So, they actually got to the same company, but not to Alexander Martins. He's probably dead now. He was an old guy, very nice person. He helped me a lot. We were actually thrown to different kind of agencies, including a police department who wanted to find the dead bodies buried in below the surface of the earth. And they wanted to see it. Virginia Highway Administration, they wanted to know the location of the old mines that were collapsing beneath the highways. But that technology was using actually sound wave. It wasn't so longitudinal waves. We're not talking about it. Okay, so actually I finished with that material, and I do thank you very much. It's almost the time for Space Report. Dr. Roy, any closing arguments?
AC2GS, I just wanted to point out that these designs where they basically just bend the light around the individual who's invisible, those are real tetchy type of setups, because any kind of motion with that equipment that offsets the sensor and the light, the image emitter, is going to look very weird. You know, when you're seeing something that's supposed to be invisible and there's just the horizon, but the horizon hobbles about and goes up and down and sideways as the person being invisible is moving it around, it becomes problematic. So again, in theory, it's certainly possible. You could draw computer graphics. You can set up a static situation. When you start to get less than static, things fall apart, and I know of no simple solutions as of yet, but who knows what the future will bring. So thank you very much, Wesley. I appreciate the topics you brought up. Andy, WA2CDL, wanted to comment on one of the previous questions tonight.
Okay, and it's always interesting discussion listening what Wesley's talking about. K2STP, Chris asked a question about splitting an antenna to two locations receiving, and I believe only receiving. Is Chris still on? All right, I just wanted to give him a number. If you guys would be interested in that, if you, as Roy, you mentioned, when you split, or when you put two impedances together, either the same impedance or different impedances, if you are splitting a signal, depending on how you do it, as you mentioned, you get a 3 dB loss. Half the power goes in one direction, on one cable, and half the power goes into another cable, and that's dealing with power. It could be misconstrued, if that's the word, or misconception. Most people think that with a 2-to-1 SWR, and I've heard this many times, oh, I'm losing half my power. I have a 2-to-1 SWR, that means I'm losing half my power. It's only half the power is going to the antenna, but that's not the truth. As Dick mentioned many times, you're only losing just a little bit over 10% of your power with a 2-to-1 SWR, just to mention that. And that means if you're putting out 100 watts, 90 watts is getting to the antenna, and 10 watts is being reflected back. That's with a 2-to-1 SWR. So that's not much at all. It's a very low percentage. As far as voltage is concerned, because you're talking about receiving, not transmitting, you're only losing 33% by the formula. 33% of your voltage with a 2-to-1 SWR voltage wise. And as everyone knows, basically in receivers that have calibrated S meters, there is, we had a discussion on this earlier, there's a good S meter will show a 6 decibel change per S unit, and that's a 6 dB voltage change per S unit, and that's 6 dB, and we're talking about 3 dB in this particular case. So it's like a half of an S unit difference. So really, when it comes down to it, if you split it, you're really not going to notice that much difference, if at all, when you combine one antenna to two different locations. I've done that experiment, and I hardly even noticed the difference. So just wanted to mention that, but I guess Chris is not around. All right, back to you, Roy, WHCDO.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. Yeah, 3 decibels, and you know, there are guys out there who would kill to bring their VizWa from 1.1 to 1.0, and they fail to kind of understand the minuscule amount of reflected power that really means. So always good to point out what 2-to-1 mismatches do and what 3 dB of loss. In addition, we were talking that using a T connector does not really allow for the impedance matching. So you have a combination of your 3 decibel loss from simply splitting a signal in half, and then you have to deal with the possible consequences of impedance mismatching causing reflection. So best case scenario, as we were describing it, was a 3 dB loss in each output, but depending upon what's going on with the impedances and the reflections, it could be worse.
Yeah, when you think about it, you know, this is a receiver we're talking about, not a transmitter. So really, what kind of reflected power are you going to be getting on a transmission line when you're receiving a signal from far away? You know, your voltage that comes down your line that's received by the antenna that obviously goes to your receiver, you know, that voltage is minuscule. It's in microvolts, right? One microvolt is minus 108 dBm as reference to a dBm signal. That's one microvolt. That's minus 108 dBm, so that's a standard. So your microvolt signal is so low. What kind of reflective power we're talking about when you're dealing with microvolts coming down the line only on a receiver? Transmitter, different story. But since he's only talking about receiving, it's minuscule.
QSTP.
Oh, welcome back, Chris. Well, let me just add, it's minuscule, but you have to think of it in terms of the signal itself. You know, if the total signal getting to your receiver is 2 microvolts and 1 microvolt is being reflected, you're talking about yet another 3 dB of loss. Again, I agree with you. Microvolts are minuscule numbers, but your received signal is a minuscule number to begin with. So it's the percentages that are reflected back as opposed to just the quantity that really, you know, is something that you should keep in the back of your mind. But, Chris, take it away.
Thanks, Roy. Well, I heard Andy earlier say he wanted to make a comment to an earlier question. I had a feeling it was my question. I had to step away for a few minutes. I came back in the room, and I heard Andy say, but I guess Chris isn't here, so I missed the entire comment. K2STP.
Oh, I was listening earlier, Chris. How you doing? you asked a question about how much loss you're going to be getting if you split your antenna to two different locations. You were just talking about losses and how much of a signal loss you would get. Was that the question?
50%.
That's the one. You got it, Andy.
I'm just curious. Did you do this, and did you notice the difference?
Yeah, so I've had it split. I had a T for my scanner antenna. I have a multi-band antenna up high on the roof. It's 40 feet high, and it comes down into my living room, which is my second floor, my upper floor. It's an upside-down house. And it came into that room with a T, with a wire into my living room that I could plug in the handheld when I wanted to use it. In the living room, and then the other side of the T went downstairs into another room, which is now the shack, and I could plug it in. Just replaced it with an antenna switch, but at the same time, I also replaced the feed line, which was an old, it was a good cable, but it was 20 to 30 years old, so I don't know what kind of shape it was in. And when I made that change, I'm getting a huge difference in my receive. So it could have been the cable, and it certainly could be the T, and I assume it was probably the T.
Just clarify, when you say a change for the better or change for the worse?
It changed for the better. The center is receiving locations much clearer on some stations that I used to get staticky. You know, I used to get good reception, but now it's getting better reception on those ones that were on the edge, you know, that were fairly staticky. They just weren't quite in range. I could make them out, but I couldn't really, you know, wasn't comfortable listening to it. So now it's crystal clear, and I said, wow, I'm definitely got a boost in the signal some.
You want to do a quick experiment? I'll tell you what to do.
For it. And I have a nano VNA, if that'll help.
Yeah, if you want to measure the impedance, you can do that. Or at least tone loss or what have you. I think Wesley said something about 50%. It's not actually 50%. When you according to the formula, when you split it, and you could calculate it, you're losing 33% of your voltage, not your power, your voltage going down the line. But it sounds like you had a bad cable. Obviously, you had a lossy line. But why don't you just take the P connector out of the line and connect one receiver, which receiver you want to listen to, just connect it directly to the antenna. Make a measurement, listen to a signal somewhere on some frequency, and make a measurement on that. If it's got an S meter or what have you, and then put the T connector back in and make another measurement and see what the difference is, just for experimental purposes, and make a note of it.
I'm coming.
So I've done testing like similar to that, but it's difficult now that the feed line has changed. I ran the feed line to a different point, and I removed the T already and put in an antenna switch. It would be kind of, let's see, could I reach? Yeah, I could. I could do it. It would take some effort. I couldn't do it right now, but I could do it in the next couple of days, try it, and see what kind of results I get. Just switch it back to the T. What I installed is I put an Alpha Delta antenna switch where the T used to be, and the B side of that switch just runs down to the second location. So it's either they're not both at this point, and that's what's working much better. But at the same time, I changed both of those feed cables, so you know, there's kind of too many variables here, I think.
Yeah, by the way, the same scenario occurs in most homes that have cable coming into the house, like in my house. You see a 75-ohm split is all over the place with F connectors on it for the cable service, because I got a cable going upstairs, and I got one going downstairs, and I got one going to the basement, and it all comes from one location, you know, from one box. So they add splitters. But these are, they're just my T's, they're actually 3DB splitters, or how many ports you have that's, you know, required, just to mention that. All right, so that was just a suggestion. I Wesley has a comment. Let me give it back to you, Roy, and you can give it to Wesley, you know, for the comments. We'll keep it in order.
Okay, thank you very much, Andy. Wesley, I'll turn it over to you for your comment, but, you know, keep it brief because Paul is waiting for the SpaceNet report.
Okay, we have two issues, two antennas and loss, and loss on coaxial cable. Signal loss through the length of coaxial cable is primarily the function of two things, length and the frequency. The longer the length of the piece of the coaxial cable, the more signal is lost. The higher the frequency of the signal passing through the coaxial cable, the higher is the loss of the given length. Now, as far as splitting two antennas, splitting two ways, you lose about half of your signal in each tab, or about 3.5 dB loss. You may not notice much except for weak signals. You could incorporate a good LNA ahead of the splitter to compensate for the losses. Andy.
Okay, yeah, there's a couple of things. That's why I suggested making an experiment and see what the difference is. But you're not gonna notice that much of a difference. Just not on the receive end anyway. You only receive it. So, all right. That's it. I'll make it quick because I know Paul's waiting. Sorry. I just wanted to make that comment because I was listening earlier and I didn't get a chance to get to the microphone early. Thanks, guys, and Chris, catch you on 75. With my ICO 720, by the way, which I do use, and by the way, that is a CW transmitter only. The modulator is an outboard modulator. It's not built in, if anybody wants to know. And it was on the Andy Griffin Show, and it was also on a Mission Impossible episode, which I recently saw. Just wanted to say that. Roy, back to you. Thanks. W8CDO.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Thank you, Wesley. Thank you, Chris. Thanks, everyone who participated tonight. I really appreciate it. As I always say, it's participants that make or break a technical net, so I'm glad to have you aboard, and I hope you come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But it's coming up to 10:29, and I'm sorry that we delayed the SpaceNet report, but here is Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Hey, C2GF, WS2N. Very good. Thank you, Roy. And thanks for all the week after week shows you're putting on here. You know, anybody that's listening, I keep track of the net, and, you know, what number we're up to and so on and so forth. And Roy has gone over the 201 numbers. Weeks since he started the science talk. I mean, he was on before that also, but I mean, the science talk started 200 weeks ago. So thanks for all of that, Roy. Let me drop it. Okay, first thing that I had to mention was NS number 19, which is stands for New Shepard. New Shepard by Blue Origin was launched yesterday morning at I think it was around quarter to 10 in the morning. I saw it. I brought it up on YouTube on my big TV screen. I wasn't sure if they were going to show it on the regular news shows. Sure enough, they did. They did show it on CNN, but Anyway, I saw the live feed from Van Horn, Texas, where they launched another one of these suborbital flights. They go up to around 62 miles, and you know, the booster separates. It's only a one stage flight. In fact, there's only one engine in the first stage. It's a BE-3 engine. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. Delivers around 100,000 pounds of thrust, roughly a million pounds of a million horsepower, if you want to convert it, to push this thing to into space, roughly about 62 miles. An airplane usually goes, 7 miles in a jet, so it's way above that height, way above the balloon limits. When you send a big balloon up, they go around 20 miles. These people are around 62 miles. Booster comes back, lands roughly where it came from, a mile or so from the original launch complex. And a capsule actually keeps going up until they get to that little over 300,000 feet, and then it starts coming back down again. Parachutes open up, three big parachutes, and then right before they land, they have these little solid thrusters that go off to soften the blow before they land. You know, they get up to, you know, speeds like over maybe 3,500 miles an hour on the way up. Nothing compared to the 17,500 miles an hour that you need to attain low Earth orbit. So this time, Blue Origin launched 6 people in one shot. The 2 previous manned flights that they sent up were 4 people each. So now, inside of 6 months, they've actually launched 14 people on suborbital flights. And this group will get astronaut wings from the FAA. They've been handing them out for the last 10 or 12 years to anybody that would, you know, that goes into space. You don't have to go into orbit, just into space. So that means Richard Branson got them, and, you know, but that's it. After December 31st, they're cutting that program off. They realize there's just going to be too many people that are really not being all that much trained. They're trained a little bit about the safety about going up. And that's pretty much it. It's being controlled by the ground. There's nobody inside the spacecraft even controlling the New Shepard. So they're going to stop that program. They'll get wings from whatever private company that you're going up on, if it's Virgin Galactic or what is company, Blue Origin. You know, they'll start handing out wings next month. But no more from the FAA. And by the way, the FAA, they just required you to get into space. I think they were happy if you went over 50 miles. So, on this flight, they did have Laura Shepard on the flight. She's around 73, 74 years old now. She is the daughter of Alan Shepard. Alan Shepard, of course, was the first man to in the United States to get into space. And sure enough, it was suborbital. 15, 16-minute flight, similar to what this flight is. Of course, he landed in the Atlantic Ocean. These people land right back on land in Texas. Also, Michael Stratton, he's the TV personality now. He used to play for the Giants, quite a few years for the Giants in football. And then they had a father and son team. They went up as well, and two others. So anyway, they're all back. Dylan Taylor, Lane Bass, his son Cameron Bass, Laura Shepard, Michael Stratton, and a fellow named Evan Dick. They all got back safely. What's weird about these flights is they don't put any kind of spacesuit on. I'd like to see them in a pressure suit. You know, you're going up, it's one of these gigantic windows that they have on, leak or something happens, these people will be toast. You know, they're not going to last those couple of minutes on the way back down. But that's what they do. They go up with no spacesuit. The same with that Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson's company. No spacesuit. They just get dropped from a carrier aircraft, and they have a hybrid motor that ignites and pushes them to the same altitude. And the difference is they come back and land on wheels and not on a parachute. So, you know, we've had a lot of people go up into space this year. Between them and now SpaceX is launching not only missions for NASA. They did two missions this year, four people each to the International Space Station. And then they did a private mission called Inspiration, which had nothing to do with NASA, nothing to do with, you know, American tax money. It was all private, and they launched four people 3 days, and then they returned and landed in the Atlantic Ocean. So, you know, we predicted this a couple of years ago that, you know, sooner or later it's going to be almost, get to the point where it's not going to be, we're not going to be able to start tracking all these names of people that are going up. I could just see that happening very shortly. And, you know, anyway, NASA is already, they're still picking out astronauts. They just picked out 10 astronauts to brand new people for the astronaut corps. So they will be trained in Houston, and they will actually be, as far as I'm concerned, real NASA astronauts. They'll be doing missions, of course, to the space station. They'll be doing missions to the moon, and some of these guys look young enough to. They hang in there, they'll be heading off to Mars as well. Let me drop it for any comments. This is WS2S. Okay, I should cover the next important launches to go up. Not this week, but the following week will be the James Webb Space Telescope. That'll go up on a Wednesday. From French Guiana. Right now it's been down there for about 2 months. They've been prepping it, getting it ready to be put onto the Ariane 5 rocket. Right now the Ariane 5 rocket is in an assembly building. It's already got the solid boosters attached to it. The Ariane 5 runs on liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen as well. That's a heavy lift vehicle. And they've never put a spacecraft this expensive into space. This thing's going to be a $10 billion spacecraft total, you know, over the last 10 years since they've been building it. Spacecraft itself is in a clean room. Just recently they had people go in there, they put on hazmat suits there, but they look like regular spaces. These are really high-tech suits that these workers have. And they loaded it up with fuel. And the reason they have the suits on is the fuel that they use is hydrazine. Hydrazine is, if you come into contact with it, it's carcinogenic. And they loaded it up also with, they don't use oxygen for an oxidizer, they use nitrogen tetroxide, which is
loaded into the tanks. We load up a total of 660 pounds of this stuff, 370 pounds of propellant, and 290 pounds of fuel of hydrazine. And that will be in that tank. The seal is sealed off. And then after that, the vehicle will be raised up 15 stories and put on top of the second stage of the Atlas V rocket, getting ready for launch 2 Wednesdays from now. So I intend to wake up for that one. That will be, if you're retired and you don't have to work, you can do that, or you can hit a recorder. I'm sure every news station will definitely record that, or you'll see it on the news at night. But this thing we've talked about for many years on the net, and now it's finally going to be going. I mean, it was supposed to launch 2017. They ran into complications, delays, and what are you going to do? The price went up. But they went through so many different tests, and they froze this thing, they shook it, they blasted it with the speakers surrounding the whole thing, audio, to create duplicate the sound and vibration they're going to get at liftoff, and it's gone through all the different tests, and right now nothing has come loose, and it survived. Survived all the tests, and hopefully it gets out to its L2 location, which is Lagrange Point 2, 1 million miles from Earth, four times the distance of the Moon. And it will be sitting there in what they call a halo orbit. And like I said, it was all fueled. It could last up to 10 years. The fuel is enough to keep this, once in a while, they'll have to, ignite the thrusters to keep it situated exactly where they want it in the halo orbit. But 10 years from now, the fuel will eventually run out. There is no plan at this time to refuel it, but they have that capability. Apparently, they took that into consideration. So that means, in the future, you could have a robotic mission, not man, but a robotic mission, go out there to meet up with James Webb and attach a system to refuel it, which would be great. And the way things are going in the rocket industry, so many companies, different countries, even launching rockets, the cost of launching a rocket is coming down. I wouldn't be surprised if they send a mission out there to do that. It's just a good thing. It's going to be great for science. Another space telescope, the Hubble, has had problems recently. Hubble had some issues where they had to shut it down for a month. They brought it back up, and another issue came up. They shut it down for a period of time, but now they managed to get it working. As of a couple of days ago, Hubble is 100% working. All their cameras and different systems on board, the computers, gyros, they keep it steady. Power supply, everything's doing good. And that's just what the scientists were hoping for. We used to talk about that here on the net years ago. Dick was always hoping that you'd have the Hubble and you would have the James Webb Space Telescope at the same time. And then you could really do an A-B test. Take a picture of the exact same thing at the same time and compare the two. For a while, it didn't look like it was going to work out. The last servicing mission of the Hubble Space Telescope was in 2009. And they were hoping to get, you know, at the time they said like seven more years out of it. And here it is all these years later, now 11 years later, actually almost 12 years later since the last service mission. So they really did one heck of a job. That was the fifth and final service mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. So there you go. Any questions or comments? WS2. Okay, another telescope just went up last week as well. Falcon 9 launched from Launch Complex 40 in Florida. They control two launch complexes in Florida. SpaceX has Launch Complex 40, and they also have Launch Complex 39A. And this one went off without a hitch. It's in orbit now. It's called the X-ray Polarimetry Explorer, IXPE. And the idea of this thing is to look at X-rays and, these X-rays, they want to find out the polarization of the X-rays coming back from everything, black holes and neutron stars. For some reason, scientists think that would be a good idea to know its polarization. I'm not sure, anything beyond that, looking at a supernova, a remnant of a supernova, or magnetar, or a pulsar, and figuring out the polarization. I'm not sure what that's going to tell the scientists, but I'm sure they're going to be very happy about it. Anyway, that went off without a hitch, and that is now in orbit. I think maybe 300 to 500 miles up. They're not putting it at a real far distance like the James Webb Space Telescope, 1 million miles out. But it's another instrument that scientists can rely on, from now to the near future. Apparently, it's supposed to be, as good as the Chandra Space Telescope, which also went up in the 1990s and still active today. It's supposed to be very sensitive. It's going to complement that telescope. And the Chandra X-ray Observatory has been doing great work for decades now. And that has a highly elliptical orbit. I think it comes as close as around 3,000 miles or so to Earth, 3,000 to 4,000. And that's its low point, and then it goes to apogee, which is all the way to 80,000 miles, which is, one-third way all the way to the moon, and then it comes back again. So it does all the science, and then when it comes near Earth, that's when it really does a lot of its transmissions. And then as it leaves Earth, it does all its science work. Anyway, this new X-ray telescope will complement Chandra. Any questions? Okay, here's another mission that successfully got off the ground. And this one was launched by Atlas V rocket, the biggest version that they have, which is they attach five solid boosters to a regular Atlas V rocket. Atlas V rocket runs the RD-180 engine, and for the booster. And then they have a second stage, which they run the A-10, which is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, second stage. But this time they ran five boosters. That's the most boosters that they can attach to the Atlas V. they could attach one, they could attach two, three, many missions have gone up with just one. This one went up with five. It was a heavy payload for the government, for the defense, and that they put up called STP, the STP-3 mission. But on the bottom of this was a smaller piece of equipment, and it's called the LCRD, the Laser Communication Relay Demonstrator. And that thing is really for NASA. And the idea is to, I know I've talked about this in the past, is to see if they can transmit with laser, infrared laser in this case, from not only, from Earth up to the satellite, but also back down again, real two-way communication. And they want to be able to do it on a regular basis from geosynchronous orbit. And this will eventually supplement the TDRS satellites. We have 11 TDRS satellites up there, tracking data relay satellites, which, of course, use RF. So you'll take, the Hubble Space Telescope or the International Space Station. They use it all the time. They transmit up to the TDRS system. They have all these, I think there's 11 of them now, in geosynchronous orbit, 23,000 miles above the Earth. And, regularly, they use this really repeaters. You transmit up from low Earth orbit, 250 miles up to these geosynchronous satellites, and then they transmit back down to ground stations, or vice versa. And they use RF, and they will eventually supplement that with laser technology. And this is a test piece of equipment that's attached to this big, massive government satellite that's now in orbit. So this thing, went up last week, and now NASA will eventually get ready to test it. They have two transmitters and receivers, one in California, another one in Hawaii. So they'll be able to, at their choosing, because it's in geosynchronous orbit, it stays in one place over the Earth all the time, they'll be able to run tests, transmit up, transmit down. And then in the near future, they're bringing up another transceiver, optical system, and they're going to be bringing it up, and it will be put onto the International Space Station. It'll be mounted outside. It looks like it's going to be mounted on the outside of the Japanese portion of the of the space station. They have this big module up there, it's 30-foot-long module called Kaibo, and they'll be mounting that on, they call it the patio, which is this large section that's attached to the Kaibo module outside the space station. So, I can picture this communication device attached to that, and then they'll be able to transmit through it, transmit up to the geosynchronous satellite that's up there now, and then back down to Earth, and then vice versa. They'll run tests. They predict anywhere from 10 to 100 times the amount of data that will be able to be sent compared to using their RF. And, of course, if there's a cloud over Hawaii, it doesn't matter. They transmit to and receive to California. When it's fully operational, and let's say you have a series of these things around the Earth, if you have a situation where you need to, transmit data back and forth, and it's cloudy, fine, they'll just use RF. But when the clouds go away, process. They'll have the that option to transmit all that data. And there's so much going on. You know, there's hundreds of experiments going on the space station all the time. And they need this large data to go back and forth on a regular basis. You know, they kind of maxed out now. And if this works out, there'll be no problem. They'll also be able to use it in a space station that they plan on putting around the moon, the Gateway space station, which is coming down the pike. Eventually we'll have that, and they'll be able to transmit and receive large amounts of data from the space station and eventually from the moon as well. And it's also in progress, you know, further down the line, doing the same thing with Mars, be able to transmit back and forth from Mars. They already have a transmitter and receiver that's going to be going up on the Psyche mission. Psyche mission has been launched in 2024, and that will be sent to, that will be, well, it's going to be launched before that. It will, around 2024, it will be at the asteroid with the same name, Psyche. That they'll be investigating. That will have the optical infrared laser system on it, and it'll be able to transmit that data back to Earth. And that's already a go. So I mean, that's a lot further out than Mars. So should be no problem. The asteroid belt is further away than Mars. Any comments or questions? WS2N. Nothing heard. Also, Astra, which was very successful, launched from Pacific Launch Complex in Kodiak, Alaska, last October. And they launched three different rockets, and the final one was successful, went into orbit. Now it looks like they're going to have one launch complex as well. Launch complex 46, they're going to take over temporarily in Florida, and they'll be able to launch missions from Florida. And they have a manifesto all built up since they made it to orbit, and they'll be launching Astra will be launching their rocket. They have no name for their rocket. Go, you know, Rocket 3, Rocket 4, that type of thing. So it's kind of weird. But, you know, there's many companies now that could do this, private companies. You have Virgin Galactic, which is now running Virgin Orbital as well. And they launch Launcher 1, they call Launcher 1 from the 747. They drop it from the 747, and this thing ignites and goes to orbit. They've done that two times already. So you have Virgin Orbital that could do that. Now you have Astra now, of course, SpaceX.
That's time
right
complete.
The other. You have Rocket Lab. They just launched another rocket last week. I think their 24th launch into space. Getting interesting and hard to follow. Any questions or comments before we close? This is WS1. Okay, nothing heard from now. We'll turn it back to Roy, and we'll be on tomorrow night. Club InfoNet comes on these repeaters. Try it around 8:30, and we'll see you there. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report and for all that you do for the TechNet and for all that you do for the club. And a special thank you for citing my 201st episode. It was way back 4 years ago, I think towards the end of September. that Dick asked me to pop in and introduce myself and mention that I would be doing the mailbag. That never really came into being the mailbag per se, but it was interesting when he went off to the airport and left me and Paul with a couple hours to fill of the technical net, and we pulled it off. And I thank everyone who stuck around.